I am Jason Bradford, host of The Reality Report. I believe that solving a problem begins by facing the truth about its real causes. Our society is pressing against ecological and energetic constraints. We are at an historic inflection point in which decisions made today will have profound impacts for centuries to come. The Reality Report is recorded in the studios of KZYXNZ in Mendocino County, California, and is a long-format interview program of key thinkers of our time. All right, welcome to the show. This is The Reality Report on November 3rd, 2008. I'm your host, Jason Bradford. In the 1990s, Jay Hansen's website predicted with uncanny accuracy key trends of the early 21st century with respect to energy, the environment, and geopolitics. What did he learn that most of us still don't know, and what does he foresee ahead of us? So Jay Hansen is here on the show. He has a couple websites, dieoff.org and warsocialism.com. Thanks for spending time with us today, Jay. You're in Hawaii, is that correct?
Yes, Jason. It's a little after 7 o'clock in the morning here. Thank you for inviting me on your show.
All right. Well, if it hadn't been for a change off of daylight savings, you would have had to get up a little bit earlier even. So we're glad it's not too early for you.
No, I'm awake now, and so it's good to be on your show, and I'm glad to answer some questions.
All right. Well, your website, Dieoff, had a page that was you posted in 1997 that has a couple of very interesting quotes. I'm going to read them here. Quote, it seems reasonable to assume that global production will soon be unable to keep up with surging worldwide demand, and that global oil production must peak by the year 2005, end quote. And the other one you had was, quote, once global oil peaks and we need to start pumping Saddam's oil, I expect Americans to invade and occupy Iraq. Moreover, profits will flow to friends of George Bush, not some wild-eyed, gun-waving crackpot like Saddam, end quote. So my question for you, Jay, is how do you think these well-considered speculations made in 1997 stand up to the realities of 2008?
Yeah, well, they seem to be pretty good. I think they seem to be good predictions, although I have to say that the predictions were based upon other people's research. I was reading Colin Campbell, and he had the stuff about Iraq and so on, and so I deduced it from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, obviously we're way ahead of the curve on even paying attention to those folks, and I'm wondering, how did you get to that point in 1997, and what were some key turning points or insight that you had that led you in the direction that you went?
Well, the key point in 1997 was an article I read by Ted Trainer in Earth Island Journal. It was called The Death of the Oil Economy, and it had some oil scenarios from an outfit called Petro Consultants, which was a very large oil consulting firm. Where it showed peak oil. And as soon as I saw it, I realized it was a really big deal. Mm-hmm. And it was going to cause all kinds of disruptions in our society.
Well, what's interesting is the price of oil that time was pretty much in the tank.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to make that pun, but... So that's interesting that you were able to see that the price is really low right now, but that's not forever. I mean, in 10 years' time, it could be totally different. So many people then first learned of peak oil from your website, which was dieoff.org. And I'm curious about the history of that website. When did you start building it? How did you go about it? And what was the purpose?
Well, I'm a systems analyst. Although I'm an expert with computers, I'm a generalist with everything else. And I had an experience in politics here where I realized that local problems cannot be solved on a local level. And so I tried to get out into the national or even the global level to try to work on the local problems I was seeing here. Hmm. And at some point, I don't remember exactly how, I became a member of what was then the Ecological Economics email list sometime in 1997. Hmm. It was being run by a guy named Don Roper at the University of Colorado. And I began reading the material that was on that list, buying books and writing articles and placing my stuff on a university server. And at some point, it became so much stuff that I had to move off there and got to my own site.
Yeah.
And so that was the birth of DieOff.org.
Yeah, very prolific. And I might just get this question out of the way. Why do you call it DieOff.org? What do you mean by DieOff?
Well, it's the reason I call it DieOff is because I see a really horrible future coming. Unless I can convince people to change their ways, I expect about 90% of the people on the planet to die an untimely death. Mm-hmm. And it's a horrible future. It's not one that I want. In fact, I've been spending almost every day, almost all day, for the last 10 years, jumping up and down trying to get people's attention.
Yeah.
Because it was like the prediction about the invasion of Iraq. I see this one coming. This one is much, much worse. And I'm trying to get people's attention so they will change their ways and avoid this horrible future.
Yeah. Well, one of the ways you've been trying to get the word out is you've been running a number of online discussion groups using Yahoo's system. And how did these get going? Was it people reading your website and emailing you and wanting you to talk about this more?
Yeah, well, the way these discussion lists got started is I had an outbound-only email list called Brain Food. I would write an article every, I think it was four times a year, and eventually I got something like 5,000 or 6,000 members on this list.
Wow.
And I got bored with just an outbound list, and I had no idea if people were understanding what I was writing or what they thought of it. So I dumped that list and invited them to join a list where they could talk back. Mm-hmm. And that's how we jumped from Brain Food outbound only list to these talk back lists.
Yeah. So it's almost countless hours you've spent doing this sort of research and then also engaging in these lists. It's how do you have the time to do this?
Well, I'm retired.
Mm-hmm.
I got very lucky when I was young and did very well on computer software.
Okay.
I've been in a computer business one way or another for about 45 years now.
Mm.
And so I was very good at what I did. And so I was able to retire at an early age.
I see. So then you'd be able to spend 15 to 20 years sort of just studying like this and then trying to communicate it.
Yeah, I quit my last full-time job working for someone else when I was 25 years old.
Oh, my
God. A long time ago.
Yeah.
And I went in business for myself. And so, I appreciate the system we have because it allowed me, our social system, because it allowed me to live a very wonderful life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to prevent other people from going through this horrible experience that I see coming.
Okay. Well, you have this history of working really hard on these discussion groups and then closing them out and saying, I'm done for now. And so one of those was a 2003 message. You wrote a farewell message to subscribers of your online discussion group in which you gave a synopsis of your research and views. And I'd like to draw on that to frame the rest of the program. And here's a part of what you wrote. Quote, by placing the results of my research in order of importance for sustainability, I can simplify over 10 years' work down to two sets of physical laws. These laws place harsh limits on what is possible for us. Number one are energy laws, and number two, biological evolution laws. For purposes of sustainability, nothing else matters. And so, so Jay, I'd like to start by going over the energy laws, all right?
Yeah, the energy laws are key. That's where you have to start. The energy laws are a prerequisite for understanding the world we live in. If you don't understand these simple energy laws, then you just don't understand the problem.
Okay. And why are they so important for sustainability?
The reason is because they tell us what is possible. The first energy law is no creation.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what that says is everything we're ever going to have on this planet is already here. It already was here. We can change something into something else, but we can't create anything.
There's no free lunch.
No free lunch. Everything comes from something else.
Okay. First law, thermodynamics.
The second law is everything you do is going to waste energy. All economic activity wastes energy, literally.
Mm-hmm.
All economic activity depletes fossil fuel.
Okay, or degrades mineral ores, and just that's the second law of thermodynamics, basically.
Right. The second law is everything you can't win. You can't even break even.
Okay.
And the third one is not exactly a law. It's an energy principle,
mm-hmm.
and it's called the net energy principle. And this one is especially important because it's so little known today. It's not taught in universities. And the net energy principle says that energy resources must produce more energy than they consume. Otherwise, they are called sinks.
Yeah.
They're energy sinks.
And why is that so important for sustainability then? What is it that we're missing when we don't understand this?
The reason this is so important is it puts limits on economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from time to time in our society, we've had great arguments about whether or not there are limits to growth. And this is a limit to growth. We mine the most concentrated and most accessible coal and oil first. Thereafter, we require more and more energy to find and produce these resources.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, more energy is spent finding and producing oil than the energy is recovered.
Yeah.
And at that point, the resource has become a sink, and it's empty. And it doesn't matter if there's more oil down there. If you're spending more energy to get it out of the ground than you get out of the ground, then for all practical purposes, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
There is no more oil.
So
it put limits on economic growth.
Okay. And I think, you know, a controversial stance you make is that renewable energy systems can't scale up to replace fossil fuels and maintain civilization as we know it. Would you care to make this point more clearly?
Yeah. The same energy laws apply to what are called renewables. But from my viewpoint, what are called renewables really aren't. We're just kidding ourselves. We've already gone through the era of the hydrogen cars, and people finally realized that hydrogen is a carrier. It's not a source of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't hear about those anymore. And then electric cars came along, but then people realized that you have to produce electricity. And so electric cars don't really solve any problems at all. And a key issue with renewables is the law of the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
The law of the minimum states that the growth of a system is controlled by its scarcest resource. Now, I have some experience with solar power, PV,
mm-hmm.
photovoltaics. We've got one on our house. We have a small house with just two people in sunny Hawaii, and our photovoltaic system contains 4,800 pounds of lead and 110 solar panels.
Jeez, that's a big
one. After about 2 days of overcast, we've got to hook back up to the grid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you work that out for the United States, there's something like about 50 million homes in the United States, which would require about 120 million tons of lead. Now, batteries only last for 6, 7, or 8 years, and you have to replace them.
Yeah.
So you'd have to come up with 120 million tons of lead every 8 years, and the panels only last about 20 years, I'm told, and we're talking about 5.5 trillion solar panels just
mm-hmm.
for the United States alone. Now, I don't know how anybody can call that renewable. As long as you're still digging holes in the ground, it's not renewable.
So the whole mining industry that's related to producing the infrastructure that is quote-unquote renewable is itself non-renewable. So the time frame that you think about in terms of sustainable society over the long run can't necessarily rely on a lot of the technologies we assume are going to help us get out of this. Is that sort of the main point you're trying to make?
Yeah, exactly. And wind and photovoltaics have the insurmountable problem of being intermittent.
Uh-huh.
Which means you have to have millions of tons of lead or something else to store the energy.
Like the lithium ion is a new one, or the nickel metal hydride. There's some other options besides lead.
Yeah, and what happens is people just gloss over the problems. You know, in the absence of a study, a study by a university, for example, not an advocate, but a university that deals with all of these issues, for example, how much lead is there? You know, how many millions of tons of lead can you dig out of the ground before it's gone?
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, unless you've got a study, it's just not renewable. I don't think it's renewable. And another issue I'd like to address is the biofuels.
Yeah.
Now, they're talking about the cellulistic. We've already gone through the ethanol fiasco here in the United States.
Right.
And so they're talking about cellulistic ethanol.
Yeah.
Well, there's a really good video out by a guy named David Fridley.
Yes.
In San Francisco. It's called The Myth of Biofuels. And he addresses the problems with biofuels. And you have the net energy problem with cellulistic biofuel, which means that you need to keep a plant. You got to have a plant something like every 50 miles across the United States.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you use more energy hauling this stuff to the plant to process it than you get out of it.
Yeah, he was on my show, actually, about a year ago or so.
Yeah, the guy really knows his stuff. And
yeah.
So we're talking about the net energy problem. And there's one other problem.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is whatever that these plants are taking out of the ground is being depleted. And you either have to put it back in or your yields are going to go way down.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, whenever a plant grows, it sucks some mineral nutrients out of the ground.
Yeah, I mean, so people that are talking about renewables, they're just not looking at it realistically. It's not renewable. There are no renewables. I mean, you can pull an apple off a tree every year, and that's probably renewable. But when you start digging holes in the ground, that's not renewable.
Okay. In your farewell message, you also wrote, quote, "With great reluctance, because it has worked so well for me, I was forced to conclude that our present system of capitalism is incompatible with energy laws and can never be sustainable." Specifically, how is capitalism incompatible with energy laws?
Well, you know, the reason I say it with great reluctance is because I've already told you,
yeah.
I did very well in capitalism. I loved it. I mean, I loved my business. I loved taking care of my customers. And I wish I could have gotten back into business, but I couldn't think of another way to get back into business because that was the happiest time of my life is when I was doing business. So I really love capitalism. But capitalism requires an endless consumption of more and more stuff, digging more and more stuff out of the ground. And that's literally impossible on a spherical planet.
Yeah.
Spheres are finite, and you just can't keep doing it. One of the examples I'd like to point out is the Ogallala Aquifer.
Mm-hmm.
The Ogallala Aquifer sits under 174,000 square miles of Middle America. That aquifer is being depleted at the rate of something like 18 Colorado rivers.
Yeah.
And some estimates say it's going to dry up in 25 years. What's going to happen when 174,000 square miles of Middle America goes dry? Where's the water coming from? It's certainly not on Bernanke's radar.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating because you have basically people living there exploiting this resource and getting by with this. They're selling stuff. They're making a profit. They're paying taxes. And yet that's the bottom line that is considered when deciding if this is okay to do, like this long-term perspective that you have of, well, what happens when it runs out? You know, academics and some government agencies scratch their heads and worry, but gosh, it doesn't seem to, the capitalist doesn't seem to care about that all that much.
No, they don't. We've got the kind of a system that people just don't think about it. Another issue is our money itself
mm-hmm.
is not sustainable. The kind of money we have in our society today is, money is created, literally, this is literally true, money is created every time someone makes a loan.
Mm-hmm.
And what this is an endless claim or endless new claims against a finite resource. Although we have more and more money, more and more claims against resources, there are no more resources.
Mm-hmm.
The first law says there is no creation. We're not getting any more stuff. So what you're really, all you're doing is you're watering down other people's claims.
Yeah. Well, this gets into, I think, why you call it war socialism, your website. Is that right?
Well, yeah, war socialism. The name for war socialism, it was a term that was invented for the Germans for a rationing system.
Uh-huh.
Okay? There's two kinds of money. There's an infinite kind of money that we have in our society. It's also known as a fiat money.
Yeah.
I mean, the money is value, has value because the government says it has value.
Right.
And then the other kind of money is a finite kind of money, like they used to have in the gold standard.
Mm-hmm.
And what this is actually a system of rationing. Since you're not creating new money, all you're doing is divvying up stuff that's already there. And with war socialism, what I'm saying is that we should go to a different kind of money. It's a lot more elaborate than that. I mean, I don't know if you want to get into that at this point, but war socialism is about rationing.
Okay.
The closest thing we have in our society that we can remember is the rationing during World War II. And what it does is it makes sure everyone has enough, but no
yeah.
more.
Yeah, I understand. We'll talk about that, I think, later on, too. This is The Reality Report, and I'm your host, Jason Bradford. Today's guest is Jay Hansen. In the 1990s, Jay Hansen's website predicted with uncanny accuracy key trends of the early 21st century with respect to energy, the environment, and geopolitics. What did he learn that most of us still don't know, and what does he foresee ahead of us? His websites are www.dieoff.org and www.warsocialism.com. Okay, Jay, after you rejected capitalism as unsustainable, you explained in your farewell letter that, quote, "My only hope was that some new form of sustainable society might be possible. So I began studying human nature, intending to discover what kinds of sustainable societies might work," unquote. And that's where we come to what you call biological evolution laws. Now, you believe this is more difficult to understand than the energy laws we just went over. And why is that?
The reason it's so difficult to understand biological evolution laws is because, number one, we're biased against self-knowledge.
Okay.
We evolve to deceive ourselves about our motives, about our political motives. And the second reason is that it's politically incorrect to teach this stuff, to teach that people are a bunch of animals, which is what we really are.
Uh-huh.
And that's politically incorrect, and we can't talk about that in our society. And if we've got a problem we can't talk about, we obviously can't fix it.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of the frustration I can sense in kind of your work and a lot of work of people who try to deal with these issues, as you run up against taboos, in a sense. So why don't we first talk about the self-knowledge? And so what is this about bias against self-knowledge?
We're biased against self-knowledge because it makes us better liars. If we don't consciously know what our motives are, then we're less likely to reveal them to others. We evolve in sort of a cold war of deception detection, and self-deception, where we keep getting better weapons to deceive others. I mean, if you look at the case, I mean, there's been some really excellent examples in the news lately.
Okay.
Look at Senator Ted Stevens.
Yeah.
I mean, the way that he danced around the definition of terms, and the idea is that we can just change the definitions of words, then all of a sudden their motives are acceptable and
uh-huh.
they're not morally wrong. Or Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky is another good example. I mean, these self-deception mechanisms worked so well for the million years in the past, but the problem is they don't work now.
So
the reason they're hurting us is because we can't face the problems that we have today in our society.
So we become such good liars that we actually believe our own lies, in a sense. In other words, Bill Clinton, Ted Stevens may have been may have been such, I guess, you know, the term that's used is rationalization, that they can rationalize actions and forget what their motives were in the past and create a new set of rationalizations for what they did?
Yeah, the way the brain works, decisions are made in the subconscious. And then about a half a second after the decision has been made, it becomes conscious to us. And then at that point, there's a feedback mechanism that feeds back into the subconscious to decide whether it's politically acceptable to do it or not.
Hmm.
And that's basically the way we operate. The brain decides in the subconscious, and then we rationalize it consciously. It gets kind of involved, but
yeah.
the bottom line is we won't admit to ourselves what we're doing,
yeah.
Let alone anyone else. And that's why we can't face the problems we have today. Right now, we're facing an overpopulation problem.
Mm-hmm.
There are too many people on this planet, and we can't even talk about that problem.
Yeah, you know, I try to talk about that in a public meeting, and you get a bunch of people sort of screaming, don't do this, don't bring this up. You know, it's
exactly.
You can do it over the internet or in private conversations, but it's very hard when you're among a bunch of people that you don't really know very well to know if bringing that up will create just sort of havoc in people covering their ears.
Yeah, exactly. You know, once we get around other people, we kind of join a new tribe, and our brain turns to mush, and we want to please the people around us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could not do what I've done in person. I can't talk like that around other people. I can only do it over the internet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the way we're made.
And just pretend it's you and I on the phone right now then, okay?
Yeah.
Let's deceive ourselves for a moment.
So, okay.
now, not only do you view the human brain as having built-in self-deception mechanisms, but we also have difficulty accepting new information that makes previous learning invalid. And I've got a couple of related questions. First, why is the human brain, you might say, constrained in certain ways? And second, what is the challenge of these insights for prospects of dealing with what we're facing?
Well, the reason we're constrained, as you put it, is simply because it worked over the millions of years that we were evolving.
Mm-hmm.
It served our inclusive fitness. And you might say we were perfect for the world as it existed 10,000 years ago.
Mm.
And these biases now, these constraints, prevent us from even seeing our problems clearly, let alone solving them.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that means we're going to do what we evolved to do, which is the worst possible outcome.
Yeah.
This inclusive fitness, which has served so well in the past, is now preventing us from seeing what we need to do to solve our problems.
Yeah. Now, there, you know, you talk about the sort of the hardwiring, and that it takes, you know, you've had to spend thousands of hours sort of learning something new. You know, there's an expression, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Well, you can, but you just have to train the old dog for an awful long time. So can you talk a little bit about that sort of research about the when brains are open to learning and when they're sort of closed?
Oh, yeah. Well, again, brains are learning very, very fast when we're young because new connections are forming and so on.
Yeah.
And connections are almost they almost stop forming at age 25.
Huh.
We're mostly hardwired is the way the research states it.
Yeah.
And so it's very, very difficult to teach old dogs like us new tricks. I mean, when I was a kid, I could learn stuff so fast it was unbelievable. You know, I was a real whiz, and although I thought I was one of the smartest people on the planet, this stuff is really difficult for me, and especially the biological evolution laws is very difficult for me at my old age now. Once you get to 25, it's very difficult, and it's especially difficult if you have to unlearn something.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so there's a difference between learning something new and unlearning. Is that what
you're saying? Unlearning makes it even more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So if people that have an education that is wrong, that is what you learn in the social sciences if you went to a university was wrong.
Yeah.
It's the standard social science model that teaches that we have general purpose learning mechanisms, and it's wrong. And so it's very, very difficult for anyone over age 25 to unlearn something they just learned at the university.
So general purpose learning mechanisms as opposed to sort of domain specific mechanisms?
Exactly, okay. Exactly. Domain specific means that there are programs in our brain that were designed to solve adaptive problems or survival problems during our evolutionary past. They're specific programs to solve specific problems. They're not general purpose solution problems.
Yeah.
General solution programs, like economists are taught.
Uh-huh. Okay.
In economics, the brain is just a general purpose computer that solves all problems.
Yeah.
And real scientists know that economics is wrong, that people are not built that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons we're having these economic crises today, is because the models that Bernanke and those folks are using are wrong.
Yeah.
They're just wrong.
I mean, I think a good example people are familiar with is sort of learning languages. I mean, everyone knows kids can learn languages and pick up appropriate accents, and if they're under five, they can lose an accent and pick up a new one. But after a certain point, they just lose that domain-specific learning capacity. So
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's easy when you're a kid.
Yeah.
Tough when you get old.
So you talked about inclusive fitness. You know, what is that again, and how do people measure it in the modern world?
Okay. Yeah, inclusive fitness has a different meaning in biology than in common usage. Inclusive fitness basically is the reproductive success of an animal's kin, those animals sharing the same genes.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it means the most fit person is the one who puts the most blood relatives into the next generation.
Right.
It's reproductive success. It doesn't mean how fast you can run down the road or something like that.
Okay. And in the modern world, how do we measure that?
It's measured based upon the amount of descendants you leave.
Okay.
I think perhaps you're driving at in our society.
Yeah.
Inclusive fitness is related to social status.
Yeah.
And social status in our society is based on money.
Okay.
The more money you have, the higher your social status.
Right.
And the higher your social status, the better mates you get, and the more likely you are to survive population bottlenecks.
Sure.
That is, suppose you were living on a desert island, and a hurricane went through, the leaders and the religious leaders and the political leaders would be the last ones to go underwater.
Sure. They've got the house on the hill that's built to hurricane resistant standards. They might have stockpiles of food. They have the control of maybe security apparatus and stuff like that, is what you're saying?
Yeah. But it's even more than that, in that the ordinary people are willing to sacrifice themselves.
Hmm.
So that the higher status people can survive.
Okay, right. It's even more interesting.
That's even worse, yeah.
Yeah. So is this why economic growth is such an imperative for our society? Because it, in general, increases the perception of inclusive fitness for the population?
Yeah, exactly. It's economic growth. It's a treadmill. It basically is what it is, and it's a positional sort of thing. Look at the CEOs that are walking away with millions and millions and millions of dollars these days.
Mm-hmm.
Do they really need that much money, or is it all about status? The guy with the most money has the highest status.
Right.
It's a treadmill. How can anybody spend that much money? How can anybody spend $1 billion? I can't imagine anybody can spend that much money.
Well, there was a big competition recently for who can build the largest yachts, and I think they were close to 500 feet. So they're working on it.
You're right. And it's status.
Yeah.
People, it's hard. You can't understate or overstate how important status is for social animals like ourselves. We kill people. People even kill their own children for status. And the Munchausen by proxy stuff,
yeah,
that's about status for the mother.
Wow.
She poisons her children to get a higher status for herself.
Because of the sympathy that results or something is...
Yeah, it's amazing what people will do for status.
Wow. Wow. So, well, what we established earlier, that continual, you know, economic growth is impossible on a spherical planet. And so What do you think happens when modern societies fail to expand their economies?
Well, that's the bad news that I think is coming. What's going to happen? What has happened in the past, I think, is what's going to happen in the future. When we can't maintain our standard of living, I think there's going to be a war. Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a global nuclear war over the remaining resources. And I certainly hope we can avoid it.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid it's coming. And I don't know how to stop it, and I don't know how it can be stopped right now.
Well, I had a professor on, Michael Clare, and he didn't give a warning as specific as yours, but he implied that the tensions are building over competition for these things, and that's a definite risk that's developing very rapidly right now. So this is sort of what is very frustrating for you, I'm sure, is that none of this is a mystery if you connect the dots, but it's hard to talk about. We have these taboos that, you know, don't talk about this sort of scary stuff, because you're going against self-knowledge. There's a bias against self-knowledge. There's the idea that we should always be able to expand our economies. That's written into our corporate structures and our government policies. And so it's a tough nut to crack, for sure, Jay. And I want to thank you for having the courage to bring something up that's that difficult and scary to talk about. Well, so I take it that avoidance of sort of violent upheavals requires that there are new social norms developed with respect to inclusive fitness. Is that what you would make a case for?
Yeah, exactly. What we would have to do, since the drive for status is innate, it's genetic, there's nothing we can do about it. What you need is a different way to gain status. For example, Mahatma Gandhi or Mother Teresa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we evolved with different ways for gaining status.
Okay.
The best hunters, for example, in our pioneering past, they had spelling bees. You know, the guys that could raise the best cows, 4-H clubs. I mean, I don't have a list handy,
right?
But I know it. There were ways before that people gained status without economic growth, because economic growth is a relatively new thing.
Sure, sure. And this year you published an essay called "A Basic Idea of How Our Government Works," in which you explain the relevance of what's called reciprocal altruism for the function of government. And the gist is that our political system is self-reinforcing, and so it will reject the very changes needed to salvage our civilization. And I was wondering if you could, put that together with what we've been talking about. And what do you think it means for sort of our ability to govern our way through this?
Well, the main problem with reciprocal altruism, and the reason I actually discovered this myself,
uh-huh,
when I was on a local planning commission here.
Okay.
And reciprocal altruism is a form of altruism where one animal helps another and expects help in return if it needs help. And so what has happened is when you join a new tribe, like a planning commission or the House of Representatives, you join a new tribe, and all of a sudden you start doing favors for each other.
Mm-hmm.
You want to please each other. And one of the reasons our government doesn't work is because these guys socialize with each other and trade favors all day long. The social atmosphere within these tribes, if I'm calling them tribes,
yeah,
the planning commission, I'm calling it a tribe, returning a favor is more important than solving a problem. And so we can't really solve problems as long as these people come together like they do and socialize with each other.
Yeah.
And the United States was specifically designed to solve problems through more economic growth. That's the way our founding fathers saw it. And at the time it made sense, because we still had a lot of frontier left. We had a lot of empty land where people could move to and set up ranches and farms and so on, but we're full now.
Yeah.
And since we've been specifically designed to solve problems with more economic growth, and economic growth in and of itself is now the problem, and if growth is the problem, it can't be the solution. We're stuck.
Yeah, we're stuck because we're
stuck. I don't know how we're going to get out of this.
Because we have to unlearn this stuff, in a sense, like you were saying. We have this hardwiring, and not only that, but then you have institutions that form these quasi-tribes that reinforce then the hardwiring, and so it makes
it... Exactly. You know, the money made from economic growth goes back into the decision mechanism of our political people through lobbyists and causes more economic growth. That is, more economic growth buys more economic growth. It's a positive feedback system.
Until it can't...
I can't see any way to break it.
Yeah, until it can't work anymore. So that's the scary thing. I find this when I try to go before a government body and basically, you know, bring up peak oil to a transportation agency, and they scratch their heads like, "What is this guy talking about? We just have a consultant's report, and we've done our studies, and there's going to be more traffic in the future, and so we have to build this highway." And I mean, it's just one thing after another like that. You run up against the fact that their tribal situation doesn't allow them really to hear what you're saying. So it runs throughout. It's very, very difficult to get around. But Jay, okay, for kicks and giggles, let's just say we are somehow able to overcome the psychosocial constraints we've just spent a lot of time discussing and have designed a sustainable society. What would it look like and how would it be governed? And I'm thinking about your essay, The Society of Sloth.
Okay, well, the Society of a Sloth was just a simple exercise, and there are many, many, many things I haven't thought about, and so I can't really answer very many questions about it because I just really haven't worked it out. But the idea is that our society is so productive now, we really only need about 5% of the people to work. They can become so productive that they can produce all of the things that people really need, not what they want, but what they really need.
Mm-hmm.
And 95% of the people can just stay home and raise their kids. And this was based on an idea that Hubbard came up with.
Yeah.
M. King Hubbard wrote an article about this, and he came up with an idea of rationing, energy certificates.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the Society of Sloth basically is. It's a rationing society. It's a move from a society where we have infinite economic growth, where solutions are solved by economic growth, to a society where we ration what's left.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a completely different kind of a society. And needs like housing, food, and clothing, and medical care are free.
Yeah.
And because people don't need money. And if we could implement a society like this, somehow we could reduce the consumption of natural resources by 90%. And if we could reduce the consumption of resources by 90%, we could delay or perhaps cancel completely this nuclear war that I see coming.
Mm-hmm.
Because the war is a war over resources.
Yeah,
and if we can relax this insatiable demand for natural resources, we can delay or maybe cancel completely this horrible nightmare of war I see coming.
Yeah, and this is the of course the tragedy of it all is that most of this consumption of resources is going for things that don't make us any happier or lead to more fulfilling lives. I mean, if people have decent shelter and good quality food and access to basic medical care, and then they tend to be fine for the most part as long as they have social groups to work with and play with. And
yeah, we have so many problems now that are caused by consumption.
Yeah.
Obesity and diabetes and all those problems that are caused from people eating too much. I mean, on the one hand, we have restaurants trying to get people to eat, and then we have the whole healthcare people saying, don't eat.
Yeah.
You know, so we've got these contradictions in our society that all take energy.
Yeah.
And if we didn't have those contradictions, we wouldn't have to spend the energy on those.
Mm. I think we have a good idea of your view in general, and I'd like to close out the show with a few points of your thoughts regarding current events such as the financial crisis, presidential politics, etc. You know, what do these look like through your personal lens?
Well, the financial crisis, it's just a symptom of the greater disease. We're bumping up against limits to growth. It's the problem has several facets to it. It's our biology, it's peak oil, it's the design of our political system. Our sinks are filling up, like global warming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're putting so much junk out there. We're getting the dead zones. We've got overfishing, ignorance of our political candidates. We have a whole series of problems. And you can't just throw money at it like Bernanke and those folks are doing, and expect it to be solved. I don't know how we can fix it, but it doesn't look like it's going to get any better at this point. Let's put it that way. I mean, the recent political positions of Russia, it looks bad.
Yeah. What about political candidates that are out there right now? You know, there's a national election in the United States tomorrow. Do you see anything coming from either of them that gives you any hope?
Oh, I don't think so.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in a way, our political system is not run by our political candidates. Our political system is run by, number one, by our biology. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every one of us is running around with a set of programs that we inherited from our ancestors. So our political system is governed, number one, by our biology, and number two, by lobbyists.
Yeah.
Corporate lobbyists who demand more and more and more growth. I mean, so I don't know how we're going to fix it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's... Is there any way that in a crisis, a breakdown, that you have people sort of they're open to something totally new, like your Sloth Society proposal, when they see the edifice that they've previously considered, the system that works for them, when they see that fall apart? Is there a way to reorganize rapidly?
I would hope it could do that.
Uh-huh.
The problem that I've seen so far is it's crisis management.
Yeah.
That is, what they want to do is solve the immediate problem. I mean, people are, at least at this point, have not been in the habit of stepping back and saying, okay, let's review our underlying assumptions and let's check our basic ideas and make sure they're still appropriate for the day. I mean, that's what a good systems engineer does.
Yeah.
Or a scientist, but... the kind of ordinary people we have in our political system, they don't work that way. I mean, I guess, let me say this. If the worst is going to be avoided, then scientists and engineers are going to have to overcome their own genetic biases about political correctness, and they're going to have to denounce people in their own university for making mistakes. For example, economists.
Yeah.
Economists stand up all day long and make pronouncements about what's good and what's bad, and they really don't know. And what we need is the scientists to step forward, other people in the university, and point it out that, hey, this guy really doesn't know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
And they really need to become involved in politics personally. Otherwise, there is no chance.
Well, I found it interesting that Greenspan sort of had a mea culpa, and you've seen articles coming out about how there is no science in economics right now. We need a science-based economics. And I was thinking about your Society of Sloth, where you talk about scientists have to be the ones that decide how many energy credits get out there. It reminds me a little bit of the technocracy movement.
The technocracy movement, I believe, was started by M. King Hubbard. I don't know a lot about it. This idea, this political idea, has been around since Plato, with his philosopher kings.
Yeah.
But the world is so complicated that only scientists and engineers can understand it, and only scientists or engineers can decide what needs to be done. I mean, it'd be nice if everybody, if everybody's opinion mattered, but it doesn't. I mean, that's some more unhappy, unhappy news. And that, you know, that people, that doesn't make people happy to hear that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter what undereducated people think.
Well, it's sort of like you can either choose to have the lobbyists make decisions for you or the educated class of scientists and engineers, I guess is what you're saying. So which would you prefer? But hey, Jay, we're running up against the top of the hour. We have to sign off. I want to say thanks a lot to you for being on the show.
Yeah, it's been fun. I hope some people get something out of it. Thank you very much for this opportunity, Jason.
All right, take care. And
bye
bye. This has been the Reality Report. Today's guest was Jay Hansen. You can check out his websites. They are dieoff.org and warsocialism.com. Today's and previous shows can be heard online at globalpublicmedia.com. Thanks to our members, studio engineer Tim Gregory. Have a good week, everybody. This is the Reality Report debrief. I spoke to Jay Hansen today, November 3rd, 2008. And I got a call in the studio afterwards. Jay said that he expected that if we didn't solve these problems of, you know, overconsumption and inability to recognize that our economic system will fail us, that we would fight over the remaining resources and that would lead eventually to a nuclear war. And someone called afterwards and said, well, when? You should have asked when. I talked to Jay before the show, and the timeline he gave was within about 10 to 14 years. And I have no idea how he got to that time frame, but I'm just putting it out there that that's what he says is the time frame. So I was really interested in hearing Jay's voice, because if those of you who've read his work, the tone is, it can be pretty harsh. And what's interesting is that his speaking voice is not like that at all. He tries to lay out the facts and the logical arguments as clearly as he can, but he's also obviously pained by this, and so this is the compassion comes through also, and so I think that's really important for people to hear his voice, because I think people can dismiss his writing if they get a tone that indicates that he really doesn't care, when in actuality the whole reason he spent, you know, almost a couple of decades working on this is because he's trying to avoid what he sees coming. What's also interesting is in his writing, his very logical, clear. He likes to lay things out in kind of like a programmer would write, you know, a code for a computer program. And so what's interesting is how when he speaks, it's not necessarily with the same style that he has with writing. So for someone who's been so prolific on the web, and it was really interesting to hear the contrast with his voice. And so I think that's a very valuable show for that reason. Now, what's interesting is how, you know, Jay talks about he's been kind of, you know, on this island in Hawaii, and hasn't really worked for anybody else for a long time, has been very much outside of the system and able to think independently. And when he went into politics a little bit, how difficult it became for him to, because he was part of this new tribe, to really speak his mind. And he also realizes that as an outsider, in many ways, his voice is not the one that will necessarily be heard. And he made a plea at the end for scientists to really step up and question their colleagues, you might say, within academia, or maybe even within government. I mean, government has a huge cadre of scientists and as well as policymakers who are non-scientists. So there needs to be a really big push by those who understand basically the finite nature of the planet and these energy laws and these biological evolution laws, as he puts them, and say we need a system of institutions that work in recognition of these and not in ignorance of them. So one thing that I think may frustrate people is that at the end he kind of tosses up his hands a little bit and says, I don't see a way out of this. And when you say something like, I think we're going to have a nuclear war, and then you say, I don't see any way out of this, that's extremely discouraging, obviously. And you almost are begging for him to come up with a solution. And in some sense, he tries to provide ideas for a solution, and like, here's what that society would look like. And we got into that, but the trouble he sees is making the transition, because we can't really recognize the problem. Now, I'm gonna give him a lot of latitude here, in that I don't think we should expect him to have all the answers. And so, I can be frustrated, of course, with his answer, but I also don't expect him to have all the answers, and I don't think we should expect anybody to have all the answers. So, you know, he's done a very valuable service just bringing up these points, and I think that different people and groups are going to be good at different roles. If there's a way out of this, it may not be through Jay Hansen, and I think he recognizes that. So, that's important for us then, who maybe have a different way, a different style, different social connections, to use those to an advantage, and not expect him to be able to do that himself. So this is a debrief for the Reality Report, and November 3rd, 2008, an interview with Jay Hansen of dieoff.org and warsocialism.com. Thanks, everybody.